Should get my phone out too.
Everybody's got their phone. Should we just get started? I think there may be people who come in late because this is an out of the way location, but yeah. We should respect your time too. So, and this is obviously going to be very informal. I think that there are people in the room who have knowledge to share, and I hope that that they will, because I don't know that any of us are complete experts on the topic. But we're here to talk about Nordic LARP in general, and we're going to introduce ourselves. My name is Jason Morningstar. I'm the co-founder of Bully Pulpit Games, which is an analog tabletop role-playing game company.
I'm Emily Carabas. I'm also a game designer, independent publisher, Black and Green Games, and I've gotten to go play games with Europeans, and it's been very fun.
I'm Lizzie Stark. I'm a journalist and author of the book Leaving Mundania, which is a narrative nonfiction exploration of LARP in the U.S. and a little bit in the Nordic countries. It came out in May. Oh, and I have postcards for it. And also, I'm helping run a Nordic LARP in Connecticut in October for an all-women cast. So if you know women who might be interested, or if you are interested yourself, I have flyers. So we would love new players.
That's very exciting because, as far as I know, that's sort of a groundbreaking thing that you're doing.
Yeah,
In terms of importing that to North America.
Yeah, I think it's the first Nordic LARP maybe to be run on this side of the pond, and the original Norwegian organizers will be coming from Norway to run the game.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So, can we start with some definitions? I mean, we know what LARP is, right? Sort of.
Or does anyone not know what LARP is?
Everybody knows what LARP is. Okay, that's a good baseline.
Yeah.
So, when you say Nordic LARP, how is that different from American LARP, and what is American LARP?
I have some ideas about that.
Well, thank you, Lizzie, also for writing a book about American LARP.
Yeah, right. Right. If you
want
to find out what American LARP is, she wrote the book on it.
So I wrote a blog post recently about this, introducing Nordic LARP to newbies for Americans. So Nordic LARP, I guess the first thing about Nordic LARP, I think, is that it's not the same as LARP from the Nordic countries. It refers to a specific style of kind of art house LARP. So I think that's an important distinction. Nordic LARP is only a loose school of design, but I think there are a couple things it has in common. There's immersion. So there's an emphasis on immersion, which kind of means the feeling you get when role play flows naturally and you're part of your character. There's 360-degree illusion is a design aesthetic, and what that means is that the game scenography strives for realism, so a bouquet of flowers is represented by a bouquet of flowers, not a piece of paper or a symbolic object. Not a lot of mechanics. A long rule set for a Nordic game is like 10 pages or something like this, which I think we would all consider pretty cute in America.
Extremely long if it's 10 pages.
Extremely long, right, yeah.
Wow. 2, 3, 3.
And so the rule is common sense rule, like if you can do it in real life, you can do it in game. And so that's also, it reinforces the immersion goal, right? If I have to whip out my character card and check my lockpick skill, that takes you out of the game. And then another distinguishing aspect is artistic vision. So a lot of Nordic LARPs have artistic aims, whether that means helping players explore like particular emotions, or just getting across a political point, or experimenting with form for the sake of experiment.
I have a question. When you say 10-page rules, that's just the pure mechanics, not counting setting description or character description, that's separate?
We have a comment from...
honestly, the first page might be something like, we are following the local law and remember these things. Second page could be something about game mechanics, if there are game mechanics at all.
Okay. But definitely, world description, character descriptions, etc., are not considered to be rules.
Okay.
They're part of the setting of the game.
But it could easily be one page that is anything that's like what we would think of as mechanics.
Yeah, I think the best definition is this, you said it quite well, that if you can do something, your character that can do the same thing. Basically, the for most of the games.
And then the only other thing I have here are just like a couple playstyle differences. So Nordic games seem to emphasize collaboration over competition always. So as someone said, it's more like singing in a choir than playing a sport. And that includes sometimes playing to lose or being like a supporting character in someone else's scene and helping push their character conflict. Plot is often internal and emphasizes character growth as opposed to being external and solvable. You know, not let's go kill the orcs, but like let's find love or let's work out. You know, that unresolved thing we have from the past. Secrecy isn't important, or it doesn't seem to be as important as it often is in American games. So, you know, if I there's this thing where people will release like all of the game materials. So for Mad About the Boy, all of the game materials are available on the web, and there's nothing like super secret that the organizers are planning or keeping hidden from the players. But it can still be interesting, despite that. And then metagaming is encouraged in certain circumstances. In the U.S., we often consider metagaming a bad thing. You know, if I see where the GM hides the secret power item out of game, in game I have to pretend like I didn't see him, right? Because that wouldn't be fair for the other players. So there's a different sort of meta interaction, I think, in the Nordic games where people work out ahead of time. Yeah.
A good example of that, as a rule, there's this rule for greater drama. If it makes sense for the drama, you may metagame it too. So you can kind of decide to die from a strike if it makes better drama, or survive if it makes better drama. So it's a weird kind of meta rule that we have in many games.
So strongly narrativist in GNS theory.
Some games are, yeah. Those that have this rule.
They go for emotional intensity, many of the games, and they feature other stuff like safe words and continuous immersion, so you can't pop your fist on your head or do this or put on a white headband or something to just blink out of character. And then finally, there's a formal difference. They have workshop. They often, but not always, have a workshop beforehand and sometimes a debrief afterwards. And workshops are a way to communicate information about the themes of the game and the mechanics of the game. And the debrief is a place to talk about emotional stuff that could have gone awry or been problematic.
So a question, I guess I'm taking the role of the questioner here, probably.
Okay.
Because I am the least practically experienced with this. I've played the least Nordic LARP. So when I think of LARPs, at least in the American context, I think of parlor LARPs, which might have 8 players, and I think of large buffer-type LARPs, which might have 30 or 40 players. What is there a typical Nordic LARP, and if so, what size are they usually?
When we're talking about LARP, it seems like there's a range, and they can. There's another category that's referred to as freeform and has several other names that we'll probably talk about. But just to set it aside, that's smaller. That's more like a parlor LARP where you're not having an elaborate set. You're just people in a room, and then you imagine most of what's happening. But when we're looking at the LARP, it seems as though the size is more like starting at 24 and going to, in some countries, you know, getting out of the Nordic countries but into Russia, there are 1,000-person LARPs
or
going on.
3,000-person
LARPs.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that's another ball of wax. I think that needs more study, too.
it really does. They're building towns on steps. I
exactly. But the scale and the level of commitment to the event seems really high. As far as like building something that's going to give you a 360 sense of the actual experience of it. Buffer LARPs are probably the closest here in the United States because there you're expected to come in character, have weapons of some sort, you're running around in the woods, you're actually doing it. But here, some of the games they're more contained, but they're absolutely, the space is crafted. There's one that took place on an actual submarine, not in the water, but the people were in the space that was taking the place of a
space
station, actually. But talk about immersion. Oh, that's a terrible pun. I'm sorry.
That's an interesting point that we should also touch on, which is sort of the cultural support and social support for these in the Nordic countries.
Yeah.
So, Mad About the Boy, how many characters?
There are 28 characters, but I've convinced the LARP writers that if we get more players, they would write maybe like another 10 characters.
Okay.
There was a game in Nordic LARP that took place in a retired nuclear reactor, for example.
Imagine the access to space, you know.
The trust.
Having government support for those kinds of things just astonishes me.
So we might mention there are a couple structural things that have helped create this LARP scene. One of them that Johanna Kolhonen talks about in her kind of intro to Nordic LARP talk, which is available on the web, is that there's this every man's right to roam in many of the Nordic countries, which means that you can be anywhere on public or private land, it sounds like, as long as you stay a respectful distance of like a few hundred meters away from people's dwellings. You can go and camp and picnic and sunbathe and, you know, gather the fruits of the forest if you do no permanent harm. What it sounds like to me is that it's easier to make like a boffer LARP in the woods because you don't have to pay for space. You can just sort of go in and be there for up to 3 days or something before you have to make arrangements with people.
There's also, it varies from country to country, but there's a strong level of commitment by the government to fund activities that are meaningful. And there was an article written recently on the Gaming as Women blog of just outlining how this works in Sweden. And so people can put in a grant for funds to have a social club for younger kids or a study group for older people over 26. And basically you can just write a grant for it. And people might do it for sports or film or some other hobby, but people do it for gaming, and it's widely accepted. And so it means that there's sort of an institutional foundation for what people do. And your aspirations can get high, and you can work with other groups so that you can actually have a lot of funds for doing something like renting a submarine or getting access to a nuclear plant. So and the whole foundation of that is that the government values this activity. And maybe they didn't start out by saying, oh, we want people to role play, that's great. But since the door is open there, people can create something that they can share with others, and it can build over time. So, where should we go next? What do we have other questions?
Well, why don't we ask if you have questions, and then we'll...
I'm not sure if this is... But I'm curious about the situation in Nordic countries when it comes to... So in America, if we were to hold a LARP with a certain number of people, we'd also have to worry about the litigious side of society. I mean, we'd have to get event insurance and stuff like that. Is there? I recently went with Emily to a few conventions in Denmark and Finland, and the way things were done there that I saw that was visible to me. So I didn't know the background or everything. I was like, America wouldn't go for this. Like, it would cost so much money just to cover the insurance on this. And I don't know if anybody can comment on.
Can you guys?
Yeah.
Yours?
Yeah. I'm not fully sure about how many LARPs really have insurance.
Mm-hmm. It says a lot right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says probably quite much. We have for running conventions in Finland, we have some kind of liability insurance, but I'm quite sure it's not going to cover that much what would be in a similar event in the US.
Yeah, we don't really have to cover the same sort of.
Right.
That's the reason, I suppose, why LARPs won't have it. I mean, if it's say 3 dozen people, which would be a sort of a medium-sized game by normal standards, You wouldn't need to have an insurance because most people have, well, everything that would be covered there, it would be covered by people's personal insurance already. There is no need to have an event insurance for that. I suppose the closest, obviously I haven't been, Nuyasota would probably be something, whoever organizes that, which would be, it's a major SCA event.
Oh, right.
Which gathers people all around the world, lasts for a week. And I'm pretty sure they have some sort of insurance comparable to Robocon. So if you have a big event like that, you would be expected to have an insurance, but it's nothing like you need here.
And it doesn't cover the people at all.
Yeah.
So everybody is responsible for themselves in every situation.
Yeah.
And even if something happens in the game or in the convention, most probably the one person who will be responsible is the person who caused it and not the organizers. If the organizers didn't kind of force the person to do it.
That sounds dreamy.
It's really hard for us to figure out the US system because our culture is so that, you know, you were the one doing this. We didn't force it upon you, so how can we be held responsible for you being an idiot falling down the stairs and breaking an arm or leg? I mean, you were the one that fell down.
Doesn't make sense to us either.
It makes another kind of problem with the SCA event and some of the bigger buffer events, because people need to have their own insurance for buffer fighting.
Yeah.
And that can be expensive.
Yeah, but then that's personal insurance for like any dangerous sport. It's going to be more expensive to have a health or coverage for that.
And that's a commitment they need to make.
Yeah, but exactly. It's their personal problem, not the event organizer. So the original question, what kind of insurance do we need? We don't really need it.
Okay.
It's the participants' responsibility. They know where they're coming into event organizers aren't held responsible, really.
But we do have a problem with underage people. Because if there are any people, depending on country, but basically under 18 years old, the organizers are responsible for everything they do. And that's a bit like expense. So we kind of try to get some liability waivers from the parents and stuff, but it's a shady area.
It's difficult.
And that's actually quite a bigger issue in the Nordic countries than in the United States, because there actually are a lot of younger kids who do take part in LARP, and even people have businesses where they'll run LARPs or they'll run camps where people go out. And I think the age span in the United States would be a little higher, starting maybe at teen years or college.
Also, LARP seems way more visible in the Nordic countries, or in many of them, in Denmark especially. There was a Gallup poll done of kids, what have you done in the last 6 months? And they got something like 100,000 teenagers said that they had LARPed in the last 6 months.
Wow.
Awesome.
And Denmark has a population, it's like maybe 3 million people for the whole country.
Four million
people. Well, that's a significant portion of children who have LARPed. So I was just impressed, you know, you go anywhere and, you talk to people about LARP and they're like, oh, you know, that thing that kids do.
That's good news. So I'm interested in theme. It seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like this art LARP stuff we're talking about often addresses themes like immigration or brutality in some way, or epidemics or tragedy that are very sort of serious, mature, intense topics that we don't necessarily see in the same way on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. Is that true? Do you think that's a fair assessment? And why is that?
I would absolutely agree.
Yeah, it's definitely a fair assessment. I think part of it is that they've got this arty academy sort of around the Nudipunkt conventions that creates theory. And I think that once you have aesthetic theory, that gives designers concepts to play with. And so I would say that I would link the growth of this arty scene also to the academic writing that's been done around LARP in those countries. And then secondly, so the tough, real themes of Nordic LARP, you know, immigration, homelessness, disease, and so on, because mostly in the US, it seems to me that we do escapist LARP. And one of the things about escapist LARP is that it's psychologically safe. It's not messy. So we seem more comfortable with clear boundaries, maybe, than the Nordicans do. And so I think that it's also a consequence of our litigious culture. Bleed, which is a term from the Nordic scene, which is about what happens when you're... Bleed is what happens when your character emotions and your real person emotions get mixed up. And in the Nordic countries, many games will design toward that, or it's regarded as an accepted... it's regarded as something that might happen to you during a game. And bleed can be messy. It can have out-of-game repercussions when you take what happens to you in-game and you leave with it. And it can be very positive. But I think that we're just a little more cagey about that in the States. We all have heard tale told of the Stanford prison experiment, right? Which is like a Nordic LARP gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And when I describe games that I've participated in or heard about, so that's the first thing that people in the United States might think about. They think, oh, so you're just tortured for 36 hours? Well, in some of the LARPs, yes.
Yes.
But it was interesting getting to run and play some games with Europeans this spring to sort of get an insight from the other side. I was running a game that had been written by a friend of mine that was based on the movie Metropolis, which is an early German expressionist film that deals with very serious issues. It's industrialization, alienation from labor, socialism, class warfare. And this game uses techniques, and it's a little bit more in that freeform camp. It's a little more loose rather than the LARP side. But it uses techniques where people actually embody the cityscape. And that's very much a part of the film Metropolis. You're using the images of the city to carry the themes of alienation and control of the human by the machine. So we did that. We played out, we were the machines, or we were the whistleblowing, or the machines that the workers were having to use. And the Europeans that I was playing with, mostly Danish, it was taking place in Denmark, but others, had a hard time engaging with it because it was funny. It was a little bit like goofy to be like playing a machine and, you know, running around and, you know, pretending you were a bird if they were in a park or whatever. And so we had to really work a little bit to engage. And most of them said, I love the themes of this game, but I don't know why it has to be absurd. And it was funny to me because I didn't see it as absurd at all. Not in the slightest. Like if we were doing something that was absurd from my viewpoint, it would have been like Looney Tunes, you know, just like over the top. But there's this different viewpoint. They really wanted to be serious. And I was thinking about how it would be if I was running that with an American audience, generically speaking, not anybody, obviously. I would have such a hard time trying to get them to engage with the serious issues. Like the looseness and the funniness and the little bit of goofiness would make it more acceptable so that we could then eventually hit on a moment where it was like, oh my God, here we are dealing with like serious class issues. And it was fun and light up until then. And so I realized that my approach in working with people in serious issues was really the opposite, and it was very off-putting for the folks in the Nordic scene that I was working with.
So. It reminds me, that sort of reminds me of Jeep Farm a little bit. I think of The Upgrade, and we can talk about Jeep Farm, which is a whole different sort of school of activity, but the Upgrade is a game designed to sort of teach you the tools that you need to play other Jeep Farm games, and it's very light and very fun, and I think we've all facilitated it at one time or another. But there can be some real pathos there. It's the silly reality TV relationship drama, but these couples have real, you know, feelings for each other, and they're really being hurt, or they're really coming together, sort of in a stealthy way, which makes it very palatable
for audiences that might otherwise be uncomfortable with many of these techniques. It's not playing a game about your alcoholic father, you know, you're on a reality TV show, and it's safe, yeah. Right?
There's distance there.
There is, but at the same time, not enough distance that you can't have those moments.
Yeah, exactly.
I facilitated a run where we had a very serious flash forward to an AA meeting.
All right. Totally can see it. Should we talk about G-Form? Is that relevant here?
Sure.
Okay. So, tell me about G-Form.
Okay. So, the freeform type of gaming is a little bit in reaction to the LARP scene in Europe, and please correct me, anybody who out there who knows better than I. But from some of the folks who I've spoken to about G-Form, it's a way of saying, okay, 360 degrees and absolutely perfect costuming, and oh my god, we're going to be in character every moment of every day, which are some of the ideals that we're talking about in Nordic LARP. Fuck all that! So we are coming to all of this with fresh eyes and are seeing what's interesting about that, and they coming up through it, we're reacting to it, and so it's decided to say, let's do something different. Let's say that we're not bound just to being able to represent things, but to have our imaginations steer us to the story and steer us to the themes in whatever way works best. And so there's a series of techniques that are, they're very meta, actually.
Right. They embrace the metagame.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
My understanding, too, is that freeform also partially developed out of the tabletop scene. So people were playing tabletop games like D&D, and they noticed that they wanted to be getting up away from the table and like acting out the scene, but they didn't want to go all the way to LARP. So this really confused me when I went to Denmark for the first time. Everyone was telling me about how I needed to know about freeform and G-form and these tabletop games, and I was like, no, my book is about LARP. I think here we might call it LARP because of that sort of physical component of acting things out. The way it was explained to me, and I thought this was the most helpful explanation of freeform that I received, is that you can think of freeform and LARP tabletop and LARP as a spectrum. So at the one end you've got, you know, traditional D&D, and at the other end you've got like high resolution LARP, you know, all in character all the time. Freeform is sort of the stuff in the middle that incorporates tabletop-like aspects and LARP-like aspects. So you've got the LARP-like aspect of acting things out, for example. At the LARP end of things, ideally, I guess, in the 360 world, there's a one-to-one correspondence between stuff that happens in the LARP and stuff that happens in real life. So, you know, so your bouquet of flowers is a bouquet of flowers, and your one-hour walk to the dungeon takes you 1 hour to walk there, right? On the tabletop end, you've got a more symbolic way of doing things. So, you know, your one-hour walk to the dungeon, as the GM, I just say, okay, you walk through the woods, and, you know, you see some bunnies, and you kill them, and it's fine, and then you get to the dungeon. So freeform combines sort of things from both sides of the equation. So you act stuff out, but you know, I can turn my pen symbolically into a bouquet of flowers or into a dagger or into anything else I might need to bring in from the scene. And my understanding of G-form is that it was reacting sort of to perceived stillness in the freeform scene. No one seems to really be able to explain what freeform means very well. But G-form is its own little corner of that world where the people who created G-form, it's sort of the way it was described to me, it's like computers, right? Only certain computers are Macs. And sort of the same way with G-form. G-form is a style of freeform gaming, but not all freeforms are G-form and vice versa.
That's right.
As a game designer, it was something that I immediately latched onto and found relevant. And there are techniques there that were immediately actionable in my tabletop design, and I found that very exciting. And the embracing of metagame is something that, of course, we do anyway. So it was very accessible to me, and probably to you too, I imagine. As a sort of entree into this world, a very sort of safe and understandable way to get into it without sort of being thrown in the deep end. So that's G-form.
Where does the name come from?
They go by G.
Yeah, there are many apocryphal stories.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of Danes. There's no need to go.
If you really need to go, you have to meet the guys and have some drinks with them, and you hear a different story every time.
I think all the stories, there was alcohol involved.
Yeah, most likely.
So it might be helpful to talk a little bit about meta techniques, since they're used in both Cheap Form and Nordicler.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And what they are is they're basic. I think of them as being a way of breaking the flow of narrative to heighten the tension in the scene. And there are like many different ways of doing that, but one of the most common ones is monologuing. And monologuing is usually used in Cheap Form games, and I don't know, maybe in other freeform games. It's where you're having a scene with someone and the facilitator points at one of you and says monologue, and you just open a window into your character's thoughts and deliver a soliloquy, basically. Sometimes it can be played for laughs, you know, if one person is hitting on another person, you know, how do you feel about this? You know, they can respond negatively in their monologue and then positively to their scene.
That's
earthquake.
Sort of like an aside in Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly, like a soliloquy, basically, or a monologue in Shakespeare. And so when you come back into the game, you know, in game, no one has heard what you've said, but out of game, everyone has. So if I'm talking about my infertility in my monologue, then in later scenes, my fellow players are free to help push on that button to help my character grow.
Something that's exciting about these meta techniques is that they're infinitely portable. So if you're a tabletop player, you can incorporate this stuff with absolute fidelity and without losing anything in your tabletop games. Well, probably the same with other kinds of LARP, I'm sure. So what are some other meta techniques?
Simple ones are flashbacks and flash forwards. The game that you talked about earlier, The Upgrade, uses that in the reality TV show format, and which makes sense because in a reality TV show, you'd always have either a monologue from someone saying, oh, this is what I really felt at that moment, or a brief moment later of you know, two people hating each other now, and then later they're having sex, that kind of thing. So that can be used either for humor or to give you an insight into what's going to happen.
And playing with time, and obviously it's a powerful technique. I remember one round of The Upgrade where we had a lot of parallel scenes, where it would be a husband and a wife and his lover and her lover, and they would be, you know, having a scene at the same time that would sort of echo each other, and that was always fun to see.
So who's calling for this? Is it the game master or the players?
It could be either.
Most of the freeform games have a very strong directorial or GM role, where they're helping everybody sort of stay on task and supporting people as they play. When we talk about LARP, there wouldn't be the same kind of role for a GM. They'd be more stepped back in most games, I think, making sure that things run smoothly or that certain events happen, if that's how it goes. But for the freeform games, like Cheap Form, most of them, not all of them, would have a GM there who's sort of either setting scenes or prompting characters or using these meta techniques. And one interesting thing about The Upgrade is that it's sort of a training game. And it over time, you as a player are sort of getting the sense of how and when you would use something. So in the beginning, the GMs, there's usually a pair of GMs who are the producers of the reality TV show. They call, you know, they say, okay, 3 hours later, you guys are having sex now. And then later on, you'd be like, oh yeah, we're having sex now, right? Because in some of the games, it you are empowered to be able to make those directorial decisions yourself.
And speaking of the directorial decisions, that is one big difference, I think, between traditional tabletop and traditional LARP and Cheap Form or Free Form, which is that the scenes are cut by the GM. Mm. So you don't just play one long scene. You know, you play out the seduction, and then the GM says cut, and you cut to a scene that's later. You cut to a different set of characters. And so that's very different also.
And having that external eye, finding that exact moment, the sort of the button of the scene when it really should end because the important thing is done, is incredibly valuable, very useful. And that reminds me a lot of improvisation, short form improvisation. You see that kind of thing.
And that's been used more in the tabletop scene in independent role playing games. A lot of indie games, whatever that means, use pretty aggressive scene framing so that they say, okay, we're going to start you right in the middle of the action, and then we'll stop at a suspenseful point, and we'll come in later and hear from your characters, that kind of thing.
there are other meta techniques that I think about that that haven't been incorporated this as much, but it easily could be. I think of things like bird in ear, which is such a fun technique. So bird in ear is something that's embraced by GeepForm and is probably used more widely. But the idea is that either the director or a designated player is going to be feeding you information or ideas during the scene. So Lizzie and Emily are having a conversation, and I'm like,
you totally want her. You know you do. Make the move.
Sorry, that
came to mind.
But that's how bird in ear works, and it can lead to surprises. You know, an unexpected play because you're getting information that you wouldn't otherwise have from a third party.
And some of this does bleed over into the LARP scene, I think, in little drips and drabs. So, for example, some LARPs now have been using this thing called Black Box. And Black Box is a metaphorical space somewhere on the grounds of the LARP where players can go to play a possible future or a possible past or to flesh something out in their backstory. It doesn't necessarily have to affect the reality of the game, but it's a way, I think, for people to further develop their characters and to explore avenues that they don't get to choose in game. So if you want to know what your funeral is like, you can go and play that possible future, even if in game, you know, the game won't last long enough or something for you to die or for other characters to mourn you, or you know, or maybe you choose a different to go down a different path with your character than one that would lead you in that direction. So I think of that as being parallel to the time cutting that happens in some of the GeepForm games. And also bird in ear, I think that is a technique that the Mad About the Boy staff used. There are no NPCs. This is another facet of Nordic LARP, is even when there are NPCs, there are like a couple. It's not like, at my local buffer game, everyone has to do an NPC shift, and there are always hordes of monsters coming out of logistics, basically. But I have heard tale told of, you know, like a 300-person LARP that had maybe four NPCs, which is kind of crazy to us. But so in this game, the organizers will play like the staff of the resort where the game is taking place. But as organizers, they'll also have the ability to whisper things. They also have the ability to whisper character direction into the ears of the players when they're by themselves.
In that case, how much authority do they have? Are they actually telling you things to do, or are they giving you information?
I think they're more giving you prompts to generate further character development. So things you might want to think about or issues you might want to explore. That's my understanding.
Find out.
Yeah, I shall find out. It is a good thing the Norwegian people are coming.
It seems to me that for some of these techniques, it would be difficult to maintain consistency. Like if you have a funerary scene and then you actually die in the game or something, that's completely contradicting what happened in the...
We actually had that happen in one of the games. It was the reality TV show one, The Upgrade. And at the beginning of the game, everybody who's in the show is at this, cast party that's, sort of at the end. And then what's happening in the game is all the flashbacks to what's been recorded over the 2 weeks or whatever when everybody's been, you know, sleeping around. And so we knew all of the cast members were there. And then at a certain point, it looked like one of them had committed suicide, and we all looked around at one another and were like, okay, how are we going to deal with this? And then we went back to the initial framing scene, and we sort of panned out. We saw that he was there in a wheelchair with his leg broken. And so he had fallen off of this cliff and just broken his leg. And so we incorporated that information, but didn't have him die. And everyone, I think the GMs were like, oh, thank God. All right, we did good. Let's go on.
Well played.
But I think that's a very good point. And it's an issue that comes up when you have multiple timelines, basically. When you're allowing yourself to go forward and back, you have to be open to doing things. And that leads to another technique, replaying a scene. Which can be a really powerful technique, you know, and that can help you say, oh, well, okay, what just happened is one possible future. You know, let's replay it in a different way. Other uses for it can be to say, maybe it wasn't a strong scene. You know, your players were going along, we framed it, and we did this thing, and then we're all just like, there was more there, and we missed it. So let's go back to just that beginning of where we played that scene. And now maybe the GM will give you a few more directives, like, you're really angry, and it allows you to express that more. Or tone it down, you know, bring it in, make this more intimate. And then you can play it again and get something completely different. Maybe most of the events will be the same, maybe the events will be totally different. And there's enough flexibility to that it's okay, you can incorporate both the visions and then move on with whichever one you ended with or whichever one felt strongest. And it makes for like a richer story that's coming out because you're getting different viewpoints. I mean, you could even do the Rashomon thing where you could have it from three different persons' viewpoint. And I'm sure there must be a game that does that.
Point of view, place of point of view, yeah.
Right, exactly.
But that's another...
So you should write one.
Yeah, that's another point of...
People mix these techniques. So you have a come in dinner and it doesn't really work out for the next morning. So the game master says, let's have this family dinner again with an inner monologue from each of the members. So we get to the points of why people are so silent on the table of
great. Right. And that something that's really being built on in most of these games and these techniques is dramatic irony. Because not only do we have the story and the events occurring, but we get to be viewers, not only viewing the events, but the inner space of the characters. And we have the difference between what they do and what they think, or what different characters think. That makes it more of a literary experience. Are we getting that back in a minute?
No.
Okay, good.
Sure. In terms of sort of crossover from one enthusiast community to another, that has found its way into tabletop role playing through a game called Archipelago, which has a technique called Try a Different Way. And Archipelago is exactly what that's for. You can say try a different way, you replay the scene and make it better, make it different, change the point of view, make it stronger.
Now, do people have any more questions about LARP, going back to that as the main focus? Or did you see anything in the book that you had questions about? Or
with these groups of such scale, is there a resolution point that people are working towards known at the beginning, or is it more nebulous? I'm very unfamiliar with this and just genuinely curious.
It's a great question. Yeah,
that's actually a really good point. Oftentimes you are working towards a point, a specific point. I think less in the LARPs than in the tabletop games. So I played this Nordic LARP called In Fair Verona. The core mechanic of In Fair Verona was tango dancing. And it had a three-act structure. And during the workshop, we all developed out our characters. We did this collaboratively with props from a table, and we each got a character dilemma, and then tried to figure out how to fit the character dilemma into the conception of our character. And then the challenge for the game was either you overcome your character dilemma and find love, or you don't overcome your character dilemma and you're closed to love kind of forever. So there are clear outcomes and you kind of know what you're playing to. Many of the Jeepform games have really well-established structures. And so I think in those cases, sometimes the structure and the plot are almost preset, and it becomes less about where you end up than how you get there.
Fate play. I heard you whispering about fate play.
Described as that becomes fate play, but I guess in the more Nordic LARP scene, as Lizzie puts it, your character might have goals for the game. There might be a general goal for the game, for a group of characters, but as often as there is one, as often there won't be one. So it could be just pure, basically, game masters write up the characters and the scene to a point, give it to the players and say, go nuts. And then the players play for whatever amount of time, And then they debrief it to the game master, say, this is where we got to. And then the game master, especially in the sort of, well, we call them city games, but...
Pervasive LARPs, where you're
per
out
se,
in the world.
Pervasive LARPs in as well, I've got experience on the Finnish scene of those, but basically that's how they work. Game masters give it, write it up, give it to the players play for over a weekend, whatever, 48 hours, they debrief it to the game masters, and the game masters go, right, so this is what happened. They write up the next 2 or 3 months, what happens in the game world, and then they give it back to the players for the next weekend of games, which they then play. And there might be goals, but it might be an overarching thing where on that particular weekend, actually nothing happens to your character. He just spends time. And then all the actual action might happen outside that sort of play time. But then it could be the reverse as well, that, okay, fair enough, next 3 months you're going to be spending out of town because of the events, what happened in the last game. And then after 3 months you return back to the city to see what happened, and then that's your next day.
There are some games with heavy emphasis on fake play. Yeah. So the game might have a fixed ending, and every player knowing that this game has to end, so Hamlet dies.
There's a famous one that was basically the play of Hamlet, but set in, what, the 1920s? Or more of a modern era.
Can someone explain fake play? I think that would be nice.
Well,
it means that a game or characters have some fixed plot lines that has to happen, that has to be acted out, or has to end in some certain way. So, for example, the game might have a rule that in the ending, King of the Realm must die in an assassination attempt. So, if the game is going to end some way, there has to be an assassination attempt. So some player will do it, or some character might do it properly.
I'm thinking of Memento of a LARP.
Yeah, very much.
Or something as simple as one of you is infected and you will all become zombies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or just get the flu.
There actually might be a game rule. The game ends when the last person is a zombie.
Right.
That's very cool.
Given that you have like 30 players, I'm assuming that at that dinner table, not everybody, 30 people are sitting around it. What's the role of those other players as an audience, or people who aren't playing at all, being an audience?
It varies whether it's LARP or if it's the freeform. Freeform, just the structure allows for audience more easily. There was a freeform called Previous Occupants, that some Nordic folks wrote because they wanted it to be more accessible to Americans. So it's a horror story, it's about ghosts, there's two parallel storylines going on, one in the 50s, one in the 80s or so, in the same hotel room, and there's a murder that happens earlier, and then there's the question about will the ghosts make the later couple murder each other. So all of this is happening, like say this was the play area, we would be acting it out, you know, we'd murder each other, these guys would have sex. and then people who weren't in the scene would be sitting out where you guys are, in the chairs, watching, and then you come up and do your scene. And there could even be people who aren't actually going to have characters. In that particular game, people can jump up and ring a bell to end a scene, or they can use word and ear to push somebody to do something. So people who were just audience most of the time, if they were inspired, they could jump up and give us some idea of what to do. And the upgrade can function in the same way, too. So that the structure there is very clear. There's one scene going on. Everyone's watching it. Everyone can observe. And in some games, there's a small enough number of characters that there is no audience, ever. Everybody's always in the scene. But still, the idea is for everyone to see and to hear and to think about what's going on. And like you said before, to build on it and use that dramatic irony to allow everybody to create the story. Now, if it's a LARP, you've got 30-plus people. There's three different spaces. You know, there's people going over there having intrigue. There's a murder happening here. There's a banquet happening there. No one's going to be able to necessarily see anything that anybody else sees.
And a black box area would sort of be a space out of that space where people might be invited to come and witness something that somebody's doing or participate in it outside of a normal character. But the non-linear nature of a LARP makes that much more difficult to deal with. So it'd be harder to have the audience and the character split.
There's also a thing in freeform games where sometimes one person will be the focus of a scene. So there's this cheap form called Doubt that's about two couples. One is actors and the other are the characters that they play on stage. And they're portrayed by four people. And so some of the scenes are focused on the real life couple, in which case the other two players come in as all of the NPCs and serve supporting roles. And sometimes the scenes are between the two characters on the stage with the non-players coming in. And so I think there's also, I think that gets at this idea of collaborative play. So sometimes when I'm playing, I'm not playing for myself. I'm playing because I want to help Emily have character development. And I think that's really nice.
Just as a sort of sidebar on that, there are also art LARPs that are intended to be played in public.
That's true.
Where you're either interacting with or there's a performative aspect of it for the people who are not part of the experience that you might do in the middle of Helsinki.
That actually gets to a contrasting approach that maybe we can talk about. There was a very intense LARP that was done last year called Kapo. And then there was another one called, I can't remember the name, but maybe it was Dublin 88 or...
Oh, yeah.
Dublin 2. And so they're very similar themes. It's about incarceration. It's about what migrants who come into a place and who have to assimilate to the area deal with. And it's about oppression and it's about society sort of abandoning people. But in one, the event was... extremely psychologically intense, and it was based on a sort of an experiment that had been done that showed that when you have people who are sort of being hazed, they'll haze the next generation that comes in. It just becomes internalized, and that was Kapo. And then the other one, the intent of it was to sort of engage the community around them. So it was set, I believe it was in Copenhagen or some major city, and it was... I'll be corrected, I'm sure. Wherever this is posted, we can put it in the notes.
It
was in Helsinki?
Yeah, continue.
It was in a very lovely major city in Europe. And and it was in an area that was demarcated, but that was public. And the issues that the basic plot of the LARP was that people were immigrants coming in and being processed, but it could take a very, very long time, if ever, that you'd be processed to be able to... get your green card, essentially, and to join society. So the participants, some of them were playing immigrants, some of them were playing lawyers, some of them were playing newspaper people, and there was a certain amount of engagement that was done with the people in the city around them. So much so that there was a person who was just a bystander, who had maybe an interaction with someone who was pretending, or acting out the role of an immigrant, and he was actually a lawyer. He got involved in the LARP, and he knew it wasn't real, but just became engaged in it and ended up successfully arguing her escape from this center. And I feel like that is an amazing success. And I'm sure I got many of the details wrong there. But essentially, I think that there's a very interesting way that we can look at the art and say, what's the goal? Is it the internal experience of the participants, which is one thing and is amazing? And then there's a whole sort of transformative element that you can have.
And am I crazy, did Kapo have people who could walk through the game as an art installation?
Oh no, I didn't know that.
I kind of think that's right.
Wow.
I'm not sure though.
So you could hear the screaming and the torture and stuff. And
yeah, it seemed like there was some kind of catwalk, maybe.
Oh, I see.
That makes me uncomfortable. I didn't know that.
I'm not 100% on that.
I hope that's true because that's very arty.
Yeah. But would bystanders be aware that they're entering a LARP space?
Yeah.
I mean, that changes things. Oh, yeah. Expectations, so...
Sure.
Calling 911.
Yeah.
Where's Dublin 2, like, they had a cage set up in the middle of the square, and I don't know that there was a lot of explanation. I'm not sure. But I think that, you know, there may have been some confusion. People not knowing
what the context was,
yeah. So that's a great question. And you got, like, a dozen different answers.
That's cool.
Any more questions? Anything that you'd like to talk about while we're here? We just have a few more minutes.
So I was once asked a question, how is the SEA different than a LARP? And I gave an answer which I'm realizing was definitely American biased. And I'm kind of wondering what the Nordic LARP response would be.
What's the difference between the SCA and a LARP?
In the SCA, there's no immersion.
Okay.
Very Nordic.
That's very Nordic.
That is very Nordic.
Yeah, I'm not actually saying that. As Lucy said, immersion is really important to the LARP scene. And it's seen something as the main thing that differs it from almost everything else.
It's a very, and it depends on who you're asking that. If you're asking someone who only does SCA in, say, Finland, I happen to know a few of those people, they're very strictly not LARPing ever. This is SCA. The difference, I suppose it, if you want to put a label on it, it is going to be an immersion. SCA won't happen. There won't be a story. LARPs will have a story.
And you're not immersing into someone else than yourself.
Yeah.
You're still yourself in another sense.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In a LARP, you're definitely not yourself, even if something is bleeding out.
Yeah. Okay.
I was very surprised. I haven't ever participated long-term in SCA, but I've been to a couple of feast events. You know, the court was held, the local baron came, and I was really enjoying it. I'd done some LARPs, and I went, and I was expecting to be in character and do these things, and it was very different. Everyone had a character, but really, it was almost you were being rewarded in this court for your real-world accomplishments, because so much of the SCA activity is craft. I mean, it was that you were being rewarded for your real-world actions, which are reenacting these past crafts, making your armor, doing beautiful illumination. And so everyone had a character through which they were rewarded, but it was interesting because it was really that just these people's incredible hard work was being recognized at court, and then there were some jokes and there was food and it was lovely. But this kind of intense having a character that you have the emotions of and have these very strong interactions with other people who are very deeply in character was very different.
Civil War reenacting would be more immersive, because people who get into that are real serious.
My answer came because I used to be an SCA active or something like 8 years, and the scene is so different in Finland because the character immersion is so important in LARPs. And as you said, in the SCA, the character is just some sort of
it's just a label for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a different label. You put on costume, but it's still you wearing those clothes. Not,
it's another
you're
element.
Not, you're not putting on another person's clothes,
yeah,
which you are doing in a recorded LARP. It's being discussed here. It's not you wearing the clothes, it's something.
You have to be mourning the loss of his father, because father hasn't died.
That's actually a similar response I gave, and
my answer to that would be that I've never seen anyone get their tooth knocked out LARPing.
You're just not playing with the right people.
But it's so immersive. Like you're feeling exactly what it'd be like.
That's why we have mechanics.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks to our guest speakers.
Yes.
From Europe. Very long sighted.
And just again to give props to Jaakko and Markus for Nordic LARP. And it's a great, everything we've said is in greater detail here. So.
Thank you.
check it out, and it's available online.